From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and I'm here every week to talk about mental health issues from a holistic perspective, which means finding balance in body, mind, and spirit. And we certainly are dealing with things that are certainly testing body, mind, and spirit these days, particularly with the devastation in the Gulf Coast area, particularly Louisiana and New Orleans. Before I get into today's show, I just want to acknowledge one of my only sponsor so far, the Rainbow Mobile Notary Services. Now, in the light of recent events, meaning the devastation that has caused a lot of illness and death in the Gulf Coast area, as well as the recent Terry Schiavo situation, each day, hundreds of individuals face difficult, life-altering decisions and are not properly prepared. Don't let this happen to you. Let Rainbow Mobile Notary Services help. We all tend to avoid stressful, emotional, physical, and financially charged issues and convince ourselves it's never going to happen to me or I have plenty of time to handle these things. For your own peace of mind and for the well-being of those you love, don't wait or procrastinate. Let Rainbow Mobile Notary Services assist you with living wills, trusts, estate planning, medical power of attorneys, and much more. Plan now, prevent problems later. Rainbow Mobile Notary Services will come to you to make sure that papers are properly filled out and properly signed and witnessed and notarized, whether it's to your home, to your place of business, or even a hospital room or shelter. So you can call them in the Phoenix area at 480-518-2090. That's 480-518-2090. Or you can visit their website at www.rainbowprof, as in professional, rainbowprof.com. So I want to thank Charles King for his support of the show and encourage all of you to take care of business. Now, we all know that the truth will set you free. The question we ask on this show is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? How long are you going to hold on to things that really need healing and some honest communication? And that's what this show is about. If you listened to the show last week, the show was actually about Katrina trauma. And I had Susan Sugar, a licensed clinical social worker in the Phoenix area and a certified EMDR therapist on, and we talked about what trauma is and how people respond to it and how to treat it and how to take care of yourself. And we talked about the various reasons why people, particularly with this hurricane disaster and levee break disaster, what they're grieving about, what they might be dealing with, and how they might be helped. Now, this is a live call-in show, and I know there are those of you in the Phoenix area listening in. I know that there are some of you out there listening in on the Internet in other cities. The number to call in if you have questions today or comments you want to make once I introduce my guests and we talk for a little while, the number is 480, which is the Phoenix area, 949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. So after talking last week so much about what trauma is, some of you who were on my website or got my email blast, which I do weekly to tell people who my guest is and what my topic is about, saw that I actually had a dedication last week. And I'm going to read it because there are certain people that may not have heard it or read it so far. And my dedication last week was, "This week's show is dedicated to the thousands of people who have lost lives, lost loved ones, and lost homes, and all that is familiar in their life in the Gulf Coast area. I send a special prayer to my friends Kira Mosley and her husband Derek Posiask and their 5-year-old son. Their home, I think, is in the flooded area of New Orleans, and they have not yet responded to email or voicemail. Like the vast majority of those in the area, they are caring and loving people, and I pray for the well-being of all the victims and rescue workers. So we were talking last week about, you know, what it's like for those of us who are not there, or even the first responders who are dealing with something so unknown and unfamiliar. And having listed that on my website on September, that was on September 3rd. On September 7th, I got this email because I still hadn't heard from Derek and Kira. And it was from a woman named Lauren Ewing. And she wrote, "Hi, Stuart. I did a Google search for Kira Mosley to see if anything came up about whether or not she was safe. One of the sites that came up was yours, tellthetruthfaster.com. You mentioned her by name, as well as Derek and her son, Ethan, so I knew it was the same Kira. I spoke with Kira's mother-in-law today, and she said communications have been very difficult since the hurricane, which is probably why Kira hasn't responded to anyone's emails or phone calls. I told her mother-in-law that people have been posting messages on search list wondering if Kira is okay. Her mother-in-law sounded surprised, and I told her I would notify whoever I found who is looking for her. I haven't actually spoken to Kira yet. She was at a meeting, but when I do, I will be sure to let you know that I've heard from you and they are in your prayers. Have a great day, Lauren." Now, that was just 3 days ago. And at the same time that I did that, I remembered I was at Kira and Derek's wedding a number of years ago in New Orleans and had a really great connection with Kira's aunt and uncle, Kel and Karen Mosley. And somehow I found their address in Jupiter, Florida, looked them up in the phone book and left a message. They called me back from Montana, said they're okay, and gave me a phone number. So actually 2 days ago, I actually got to speak at length to my friends Kira and Derek, and they made it out to Derek's parents in Baton Rouge. And as we were talking, it became evident that while so much outpouring of love and support is going to so many of the disenfranchised and struggling evacuees that are in shelters and didn't have other places to go, and the people who are still being rescued, very little has been talked about the middle class, many of whom were able to get out because they had the vehicles, they had the credit cards, they had the financial wherewithal, and the ability to get out in advance, unlike a lot of those in poverty around New Orleans that really didn't have the ability to get out real quickly. So we started talking about that, and in the LA Times on the 8th, there was actually an article about this, "Middle Class Exiles Struggle for a Foothold." I just want to read a couple of paragraphs because, surprise, surprise, my guests today are Kira and Derek, and I'll be introducing them in just a moment. But the beginning of this article reads, it's called "Middle Class Exile Struggle for a Foothold," and it's written by J. Michael Kennedy and Jean Guccione from the LA Times staff. And it starts with, "Kevin Lippy Morby is a middle-class guy who used to make a good living with the music store he owns in the French Quarter. Now he's staying with friends in Austin, Texas, has a couple of changes of clothes, and what little remains of the $200 he had in his pocket when he fled Hurricane Katrina. Katrina has robbed him of his living, he says, and the government doesn't have a system in place to help evacuees who aren't destitute. I'm afforded virtually no assistance because all the resources are going to the desperately poor, he said. My belief is that relief agencies don't know how to deal with a middle-class refugee. My problem is that I'm going to look like a crybaby if I say I'm out of work. He is not alone. Many members of New Orleans' middle class find themselves stranded between not yet destitute, and watching their bank accounts shrink because they have lost their source of income. Even those who think they could restart their lives in the city cannot try. They are barred from reentering the area for the foreseeable future." And in today's Times, in an editorial, they started in reference to the new bankruptcy laws. The first paragraph reads, "Government aid is finally flowing to the most helpless victims of Hurricane Katrina, but a broader category of the dispossessed will test the government over a longer period of time. They are families with the means to flee the hurricane, perhaps even with insurance to cover some losses, but without the resources to make a living immediately. In other contexts, they would be referred to simply as the middle class. They have lost their homes, but are living off their credit cards and maybe a little savings. As those savings dwindle, however, the mortgage keeps coming due and the credit card nears its limit. Soon the paycheck may stop, and with it their health insurance." So this was an awakening for me, because it's really, if you read, other than that one article, I've seen very little about this. So without wasting any more time, I really want to get to my guests, who I'm thrilled to be talking to again and know where they are. Kira and Derek, you both there? Okay, you need to speak a little louder into the phone. First of all, God bless you both. And I want you to apologize to Ethan, because in my dedication I actually called him Evan. So I apologize for that. But can you comment on what I've said so far, but also can you tell your story about what happened to you and what you got out, and is your house still standing? What's the situation that you're in right now?
Well, as far as I know, our house is standing, but I know nothing beyond that as far as where the water got to, if we even got water. I know we currently have water on the street, but it's not, it doesn't sound like it's that high, so I don't know how high the water actually got.
Mm-hmm.
As far as our getting out, we heard about the hurricane. The hurricane hit kind of strange. Normally, it slowly makes its way into the Gulf, and this time I think a lot of us didn't really pay attention to it because it was hitting Florida, and we didn't really know. I mean, we knew it was there, but it didn't seem like a threat to us. So I heard something about it Friday evening, and we checked out the news later on Friday night and realized, well, this could be serious. It's already a Category 3, and it had just gotten off of Florida, and they had all the tracks coming right at us. So Kara and I talked at length about whether or not we were going to get out of town, and we decided, well, we'll wait until Saturday morning to make a decision. Saturday morning, the news really got dire, and I began boarding up the house while Kara began packing up for us, and we probably didn't finish until, I don't know, 5, 6 in the morning, following morning.
Sunday morning.
Yeah, because the house was so, we have a large house. We downstairs is a rental unit, and I was helping them get their stuff out. And it so about 6 a.m. Sunday morning, we were ready to pack up the cars and leave, and then we got into the Contraflow system, which was not nearly as bad as they made it out to be on the news. I think that was one of the things that New Orleans definitely got right this time, was the evacuation routes for people with means to get out. And we made it to my folks' house in a little over 2 hours, which was not that bad. So, you know, we came to Baton Rouge and just battened down the hatches here and sat it out.
So you're there with your parents, the three of you, plus two dogs and a cat, I think?
Two dogs, a cat, two lizards, and two hermit crabs.
Oh, my God. Okay. I'm just glad you were one of the smart ones and did that. Now, some people would say, well, this is a no-brainer. I mean, what's your state of mind at this point? I mean, are you in shock? Are you dealing with what needs to be dealt with? You know, where are you, and how's Ethan handling it?
Well, right now, we're kind of through the shock. I'd say the state of shock has lasted the past 2 weeks, though.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was the initial, well, it didn't hit New Orleans nearly as bad, and then there was the flooding, and then, you know, the, oh, my God, people are dying left and right in New Orleans. So there was definitely a lot of shock over that, and slowly realizing that we may never be able to have our lives in New Orleans again. And I don't know that we're really over that yet. My son, Ethan, he's kind of taking it all in stride. You know, I think when you're six, everything's an adventure. So, you know, he's staying at Grandma and Grandpa's and gets to play with Grandma and Grandpa. And, I know he's kind of bouncing off the walls now, but and he
he does tell me, you know, he's sad that we may not have our house. He's sad that he's sad for the people in New Orleans because he's been watching the news with us too. So, I think he's handling it about as well as he can, and we're handling it about as well as we can. But every day is kind of something new for us. You know, there's the taking care of calling the credit companies, you know, calling the mortgage company, calling all those people, calling the insurance company.
How are they responding to you? I mean, what are they saying to you?
Well, it's kind of interesting. The initial phone call we made was to our mortgage company, and they were fantastic. They immediately were very sorry and told us not to worry about it, give them a call back in November, and at least let them know where we are on things. Don't worry about payments. You know, because, again, you know, we don't have employment right now.
Right.
So it's the, you know, they were very understanding right away. Interestingly, Kara called another company who we have a car loan through and we have a credit card through, and they didn't deal with, they were out of the West Coast and predominantly dealt with West Coast people. So it was really interesting. They didn't realize what had happened for the most part.
Are you kidding me?
No. This was the day after the hurricane, and once we started realizing we're not going to be able to go back for quite a while, that was the second call she made, and or actually the second company she could get through to. We tried to call everybody, but communications were pretty hard. It was hard to get through to anybody, really, at that point. But, yeah, she calls this company, and the first thing they start telling her is, well, of course you have to pay your bills. And, you know, Kara explained, well, we just had this hurricane. You don't understand. Well, we heard something about that. Interestingly, the next day they called back and were very apologetic.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, said, don't worry about anything right now. And, you know, it was a 180, but the initial thing was they obviously hadn't really had anybody, you know, they had very few loans in the Gulf Coast region. So
uh-huh.
They hadn't had many of us. So I guess the joke is the way Americans think of the rest of the world is the way Californians think of the rest of the United States. You know, they don't. So,
okay. I'll take that with a grain of salt. Thank you.
I'm in Western California.
So. Okay. So basically, you're taking it a step at a time in terms of dealing with the practical issues.
Yeah. Each day you realize, oh, gosh, you know, what about this? And what about this? And, you know, where are we going to get payment? What are we going to do for employment? And
right.
We just the other things like qualifying for food stamps.
Right. And here you are middle class with a decent income and standing in line to apply for food stamps. How must that have felt to you?
Yeah, that's a very humbling experience. I stood in line for food stamps for about 6 hours on Thursday and then had to go back today to actually get them and waited for another 2 hours. And it's a very, it made it all very real for us.
Uh-huh.
You work very hard for the things you have and for the life you have. And, you know, now we're getting on the government dole, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, when you move back in, you work very hard for your life, then you have to move back in with your mother and father. And
at age what?
Food stamps.
Right.
It's very humbling.
Yeah.
And if I can add in for a second.
Yeah, you're allowed, Kara.
Stuart, I think your perspective about and what you read about at the front of the beginning of the show was dead on. And I think that's what Derek and I are starting to realize now that the impending, you know, danger is somewhat stabilized, is that those of us who had some insurance but were living pretty much check to check.
Like most middle-class people do in this country.
Right, and it's going to be extremely difficult to rebuild our lives. And I think in addition to how many friends we had that were on the front line that had to stay because of they were MDs and they stayed at the hospitals, they were working security at the Superdome, so many of our friends who were first line, a lot of them were in the same situation we are, which is a lot of them are actually having to leave. They're having to move out of state. Two of the biggest tragedies for me, and what I think is hardest for me right now, is not the loss of items or belongings. it's the complete loss of the community that we had in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
New Orleans is very different than the rest of the United States. Community is extremely important. It's a very networked place. We know all our neighbors. We spend time with our neighbors. We chose to live where we live because of that history and those networks and extended support systems.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're watching most of our friends having to be forced to move away. A lot of the top for-profit and nonprofit organizations were some of the first to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And they've already relocated to other states.
Right.
So it, not only did the tragedy hit, but a lot of the stabilization companies are gone. And a lot of our friends have been put in the position of, if you want to keep your job, you need to relocate with us.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking at, I just lost everything I own, and if I want a job, I have to move and start all over again somewhere. And so it's really ripping apart, I think, the social fabric of the greater New Orleans area. And it's not just New Orleans. I mean, the whole five, six parishes that got hit is one of our best friends. Their house is completely underwater. They've lost everything they own. They have three small children. The littlest was born less than a month ago, and she lived half a mile from her father, a few blocks from her sister, and her biggest pain is that type of living environment will never be available to them again.
That real sense of groundedness and extended family is what you're
right.
talking about. I talked about that on the show last week, is that, you know, there's the issue of loss through death, or loss through, you know, jobs, health, things like that. But I said the same thing last week on the show, where one of the biggest losses I think most people are going to find is that sense of history and environment, familiarity and community, which is the most difficult thing, because if you are surrounded with loved ones, at least there's that sense of belonging. And
right.
when you're left and having to start over and don't have those familiar contacts and connections,
right.
Most people underestimate the impact and power that of what you're talking about right now.
And most people we know would prefer and are committed to going back to rebuild, but some of them just aren't going to be able to because they won't have any jobs.
Right.
So even if they wanted to come back and rebuild, they have no income.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's devastating on so many levels. And I would echo what Derek had said about, I think most of the area that was hit is still in shock.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we're just starting to kind of come out of a haze, and now the real difficult stuff's on the table of what do we do now?
Mm-hmm.
And we are definitely caught where the only thing we qualify for right now is food stamps. We've already been turned down by FEMA. We don't qualify for the vouchers President Bush has talked about for $2,000 per family.
Mm-hmm.
We don't qualify for anything. The only thing FEMA offered us was a small business loan with a 30-year payback at 5% interest,
right.
which we don't need more debt.
Right.
So it's very disheartening for us. And,
right.
And we're not, you know, the stress in addition to the trauma we just went through is pretty unbearable for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And
a lot of it hasn't even hit them yet because, you know, we're talking about post-traumatic stress, which is something that usually shows up in, we talked about this last week too, about maybe 15% of the people who go through a trauma actually have these symptoms, but we're not going to know who's coping and who's not for at least another 4 to 6 months.
Right.
Now, we talked about the two of you being middle class, but I really didn't get a chance to introduce the two of you other than as friends of mine. Now, both of you are PhDs in very different areas, in a sense. Derek, let's start with you. I mean, I know you worked at Tulane and did research, and what you told me on the phone the other day is that, like, 3 years of research that were in the refrigerators is now all gone. What kind of research, what's your PhD in, and how does that feel to see 3 years of your work just, you know, because the refrigerators didn't have electricity, all of a sudden that's all gone?
Yeah, it's...
What's your PhD in?
Well, my PhD, I got it in pathology from LC Medical Center, which is kind of right down the road from where I was currently working, Tulane University. Tulane, I've been doing I'm on a postdoctoral training fellowship, and I've been doing research in lung.
lung disease is primarily the development of fibrosis, fibrotic lesions in the lung. Fibrosis is one of the number one killers in lung disease. It's called idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. People, they don't know why people have it, but it's there in the lung and people can't breathe. So that's what I do. I study fibrosis. We use genetically engineered animals, mice and rats, for the research. And, you know, a lot of what you do are large studies, you know, studies of, say, 50 or 60 mice, or you do cell culture, and you have enough time to do the experiment but don't have enough time to actually get the results. So you get the samples and you put them in the freezer, and, you know, you're dealing with experiments from before, and so everything that's in the freezers is gone.
Mm-hmm.
All the reagents are gone. Everything that, all the animals, I'm certain, since they've had no electricity at Tulane. Tulane was right next to Charity Hospital, which they showed a lot on the news, which
mm-hmm.
was, at least the first floor was underwater. So I don't know how much of my area was underwater, but I'm sure at least the first floor was.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to interrupt you for a minute because I know that there's a lot of static on the line, and I'm just letting my listeners know to be patient because Derek and Kira are calling from Baton Rouge, and the telephone lines still are having some problems. So it's not the station. It's actually the phone lines coming out of where Kira and Derek are. So I'm just asking my listeners to be understanding and patient and listen through the static. So
Yeah, I apologize, too.
No, it's not your fault. It's nothing to apologize for. So, you know, this is one of the other things. I mean, we go on and on. One of the articles I read in the paper today had to do with a lot of it. Like, for example, in Louisiana, they don't have deeds. Everything's like a paper trail. So the only proof of ownership of things is a recorded record and or some kind of whatever it is. And, like, you know, a lot of these records were also destroyed, you know, historically. So there's a lot of things, like your research,
right,
that as people are uncovering, they're going to find that losses, although I understand that a lot of the museums weathered things pretty well, but, you know, there's some Frank Lloyd Wright homes. I mean, architecturally, things that you don't want to, you don't see as priorities right now, the implications and ramifications of the environment that Kira was talking about, which is the historical richness of this area.
Yeah, that's what we fell in love with in New Orleans. It's the large oak trees that have now fallen everywhere. It's
mm-hmm.
the architecture. I mean, our house, we fell in love with it because of its architecture. And
mm-hmm.
it's all those things that make you put up with the other problems that New Orleans, you know, been notorious for. But it's the things that you have a very rich community as far as personalities, as far as kindness, and you have this just wonderful architecture and things that you don't get really anywhere else in the United States,
mm-hmm.
in the suburbs.
Right.
You know? And how is New Orleans going to recover from that? Is that still there? And we don't know.
Yeah. Well, it won't be known for a few months yet, I would imagine.
Right.
Now, Kira, what's your PhD in, and what have you been doing?
I've got the most misunderstood doctorate in the world, probably. It's called a doctorate in public health.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a public health professional, and it's a very applied degree to kind of be in the trenches. And I've worked predominantly with nonprofits, frontline nonprofits, that are doing the hardcore services for those that either are absent from care, have had a tough time getting into care, or have been neglected because they're too hard a population to provide services to.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked in just about every aspect, from chronic and infectious disease to substance abuse and mental health, and the last 10 years I've been working a lot with corrections and working a lot with the correctional health systems. And I've been working inside prisons, running health programs, and also outside doing a lot of consulting in improving their inmate programs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm currently the lead evaluator of their prisoner reentry initiative for the state, or at least I was.
Right.
I'm not sure what all this means now.
Well, because there are no prisoners there. Now they've all been dispersed to other facilities.
Right. And I've been, well, And Orleans Parish Prison, located inside New Orleans, is one of the largest jails in America.
Wow.
And it had 6,500 inmates when the storm hit. Mm-hmm. And without getting too political,
you can get as political as you want on this show. Okay. Well, I have, and you're allowed. I know Kira, and I know once I open that door, we're going to get going here. So feel free to say what you want to say, Kira.
It appears that the currently or recently elected sheriff that came in, who was very new and had no background in corrections, basically put the system on lockdown and left. And for most of us, the perception was that he left people there to die, his staff and the inmates. And the Louisiana Department of Corrections, on their own initiative, came down. And they actually came down and rescued every inmate, moved them up to the infamous Angola prison and other prisons. They moved all 6,500 out. And they actually got in and transported inmates out before FEMA even got on the ground.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it was a local response, even though some of the local people disappeared on the job. Now, you and I have known each other since the early 90s, when I was with the International AIDS Project that I founded and doing AIDS and AIDS prevention and education programs in Russia and the former Soviet Union, and you were with an organization called the National Council on International Health.
Right.
And you actually helped me remember where we first met, which was through that work and the conference that you single-handedly practically put together in Washington, D.C. to really educate the international community on what was about to happen in the former Soviet Union when it comes to HIV and AIDS, which is what my work was about then, too. So you also were a U.S. Peace Corps health volunteer in Sierra Leone. I mean, you've seen some really horrific things in your life in terms of being in the Peace Corps and stuff. How does this compare, what you're seeing now in our own home?
I think, well, obviously, this is far more personal because it's my city, it's my home, mm-hmm. it's where my heart is. Sierra Leone at the time was the poorest country in the world, and so I had no water, no running water, no electricity. I lived way out in the bush, completely off the land, isolated. And it was.
But you also knew it was a temporary situation for you, and that someday
right.
you'd be going home to a
right.
nice warm bed.
Right. It was a temporary situation, and I wanted the experience, and I think. The good news is it provided me a fabulous foundation for empathy and understanding of what so many people in poverty in the United States deal with
mm-hmm.
and try to get out of or, you know, get past. And I think it made me a far more kind and empathetic person. And, again, I got to leave.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the country went to war. They had their first civil war. While I was there, and I was one of the few who stayed behind and was not part of the original evacuation. And to watch people, and this is, I think, the parallel for me for New Orleans, is to watch people where there was not a single gun in the country go to suddenly U.S. and other country troops on the ground training people how to use guns and bayonets and everything else was not only surreal, it was devastating to watch. And watching people do things they never would have done before, and watching what people do when they're in crisis and trauma and in a war. And for me, I think that helps to explain some of what happened in New Orleans when people were starving, when they didn't have access to water, when they were trying to survive. And it's unfortunate, I think, that the nation is seeing that as the few clips the media provides on, you know, some of the looting that happened. We have MD friends, medical doctors, who broke into Walgreens and other stores to get food for their patients. So the amount of looting for personal gain, I think it was over-exaggerated. Yes, of course mm-hmm. it was there, but people have to understand when you're under those kind of circumstances, you're going to do things.
Right. Well, even a lot of the police officers said when they saw people carrying bread and water, they didn't care. They said, go ahead and get what you need, because they knew this was necessary, and that stuff was just going to end up sitting on those shelves anyway. Even there was, I think it was 2020 last night, they did a thing on the police department in New Orleans and how many stayed behind to really help, and how the police chief that was working with a band that were living in a Walmart because they chose not to leave, you know, said, you know, are we criminals now because we're eating Walmart's food off the shelves? But no, we need to survive.
Right. And that, I think it's very unfortunate that the other aspects of the demographics of New Orleans have not been pulled into focus. New Orleans is one of the poorest cities in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the sickest. It's one of the most incarcerated. It's one of the most violent. Historically, New Orleans has had multiple and far-reaching impediments to development. And when this hit, a lot of the folks who did not leave, I bring it down to three categories of folks who didn't leave. One were the people that had absolutely no way to get out. They did not have the resources. They did not have the money. They did not have the transportation. The second part, I think, obviously we had a small, very small percentage of people that stayed behind to take advantage of the situation once the storm had passed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have another group that were stayed behind to protect what they own,
right?
To protect what they did have in fear of losing it and not being able to ever replace it. When they talk about it, and watching national experts sit in Washington, D.C. or New York and talk about, you know, the dynamics or the pathology or the social dimensions of what people did is very upsetting to someone like Derek and I who were there, and we understand the community. Personally, I like to take someone like Dr. Phil, put him on a boat, and let him drive through the area before he starts talking about, you know, what needs to happen or how people need to react or how they should cope with it, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you've lived through it, we have a really tough time watching other people both personalize and tell us what to do, especially when the federal response was so inadequate.
Right. So you do experience that, you know, because there's still such debate as to, I mean, obviously it's the blame game, as Bush's people keep saying, we're not doing the blame game. But, you know, I mean, but they're pointing fingers back at the mayor and the governor, and they're pointing fingers at the Bush administration. This consensus seems to be that, I mean, how can you fault the mayor whose own resources were underwater and the police department who lost most of their vehicles and half of the force? They were relying on state and federal support at that point. And whatever was going on between the governor and the president and stuff, you know, I don't think we'll ever know. But it was true that the federal response, and we keep hearing these horror stories of people saying, I brought all of these supplies and FEMA wouldn't let me in. They said they didn't need it. You know, we had these trucks and the buses that could have gotten all these people out of there are now under 6 feet of water.
Right.
All the school buses. They showed this parking lot filled with these school buses that could have been evacuating people who are now dead.
Right. And I think part of the biggest frustration is that it's not that Louisiana has not been asking for funding to repair and strengthen and build up the walls and the levees and, you know, the system so that something like this would not happen.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been asking for several years, and we've always been turned down and have decreased funding, the coastal erosion issue. And part of the frustration is it's not that we haven't been asking. So when people say, well, you know, Louisiana's responsible for the poverty in New Orleans, I have to go back to we're a state of a nation.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been asking for resources, and we're often denied resources.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, we're third in industry in America, and I think America has been very educated over the last 2 weeks of how important Louisiana is to the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding economics, regarding gas, oil, and how much we actually produce here.
Yeah, we may be kind of a poor hick state to some people, but you know, you're watching your gas prices rise right now as the refineries can't open, and you know, that's a very telling sign to the importance of Louisiana and the economy of the United States. And you know, I also think that, you know, to say that we were unprepared for this, I think the response people were very unprepared, but we knew that this was going to happen. This was known.
It was inevitable. Sooner or later, a storm was going to hit directly. I mean, they couldn't keep, you know, dodging the bullet forever.
Right. There's an article in National Geographic, October 2004, that describes this scenario to a T.
And it starts off by describing all this. And I was reading the article to my mom and Kara, and, you know, that as I was reading it, they were kind of saying, yeah, so what? But then you get to the kicker of the article, which says, well, this storm hasn't happened yet, but this is what they're preparing for. And supposedly FEMA considered that a direct hit to New Orleans the number one threat to the nation as far as national disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it's not like this wasn't known that it could happen.
Right.
And it's not so this lack of preparation is just mind-boggling. But, you know, even with that, you know, knowing what the devastation that could happen from a hurricane, to be honest, this is the first one that Kara and I have packed up the car and left for.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there's always been that kind of fine line between, well, is it going to be that bad? And, you know, we want to protect our stuff, our home, our life.
Right.
And, you know, we did deliberate. I mean, you know, fortunately, we were smart enough to not deliberate that long. But, you know, there's always been kind of that question. You know, as the hurricane comes rumbling up, we kind of say, well, no, it's only a Category 1, or it's only a Category 2, or it's going to miss us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's also kind of the mentality. You know, we've been lucky for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we've been saying year after year that this is a major threat. And given how much money has been poured into Homeland Security,
right,
as far as I'm concerned, and given that I'm an expert in public health, what happened is completely unacceptable and inexcusable.
I know they keep calling this a natural disaster and stuff like that. To me, this is such a man-made disaster, and why they keep calling it a natural disaster, I have no idea, because they don't want to take responsibility. This is a man-made disaster. This is
right.
About the levees. You know,
right.
the city weathered the storm with some damage, but it was the levees that humans built and humans refused to shore up,
right,
that caused the devastation that's there.
Right. And if you look back on the records of how much money Louisiana was asking for, I think they were asking for about $500 million to really stabilize and build up that area so that
right.
this would not happen. And now look at how much they're going to have to spend for what happened.
Well, already $60 billion and counting,
exactly.
Not to mention the lives that are lost and the lives that have been displaced.
Exactly.
You know?
And
now, Derek, you mentioned National Geographic from 2004. What was the month of that?
I believe it was October 2004.
Okay, because I want to get a copy of that.
Yeah, I'm almost positive that's it. And it,
mm-hmm.
it describes it to a T.
Mm-hmm. Now, go ahead.
I'm sorry. One other thing I was going to add, and I know my perspective may be a little harsh, but having been in Sierra Leone, in the poorest country in the world, and watching relief flown in, watching how they did it and they delivered it, the fact that they could not, I mean, there were other things the United States government could have done immediately. They didn't need a green flag to do things like load up a bunch of planes with big plastic bags filled with life jackets, rafts, food, water, a waterproof radio, and drop them every 50, 100 feet to at least give people basic needs until they could hold on for relief to get on the ground.
You know, it's the first time I'm hearing anyone mention that in the sense of the rafts and the life jackets, the radios. I mean, I've heard people say, why didn't they just go in and drop water and stuff? But that, what you just said, is like such basic common sense.
Right. And that's what I find unforgivable. And I don't know how much money we poured into for Homeland Security and natural disasters, but how would they not hit that one?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, that's inexcusable. And for 5 days to finally get anything on the ground, and how many people had died because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is what's so inexcusable. I've watched them do it in other countries. I watched them do it within 24 hours. And that's what I couldn't believe. And New Orleans was begging for help. We had no communications. I think, I don't know how much national play was done with some of the early interviews with our parish presidents and mayors when all this happened, but even Jefferson Parish right next to us, who took a major hit, their president literally seceded from the nation. His point being that obviously other countries receive aid faster than United States citizens can.
So that's a very appropriate slap in the face to the federal government.
Right.
Yeah.
But again, people doing it, all of our parish presidents and mayors broke down into tears, all of them, because of what they watched happen.
Derek, you told me a story on the phone the other day about your friend who is the doctor who was in such shock. Could you talk about him? Because, I mean, on the one hand, this guy, I mean, stayed behind and did what he needed to do and was a real hero in the mix of it. And on the other hand, the way you described it was just such a human ache that he was going through.
He was in University Hospital, which was one of the ones that was on the news as not having gotten the patients out, and nobody knew that the patients were there or had not gotten out until like 4 or 5 days into this. And he was one of the last people out. And he and another doctor friend of mine who was at a neighboring hospital just have awful stories. And all the rumors, and I'm not going to get into everything, but all the rumors that were heard, at least on the local news, seem to be true, at least from what I'm hearing from these guys. And he got out. He came to Baton Rouge, which is about an hour away from New Orleans, and he spent one night here, and then he got a plane ticket to South Carolina. My other friend was supposed to pick him up, and he got
and take him to the airport.
Right, and when he got to the apartment, my friend Mark wasn't there. He had just started walking. He had gotten on the interstate and was just walking down the interstate because he had to get out.
I mean, that just such focus and such numbness that just said, I just need to get out of here. I'm getting to the airport. I'm not waiting for the ride. I mean, I'm sure he was in like a state of oblivion while he was doing that walk.
Right.
Did you get my email from your friend Hugh?
Yes, I did, actually.
Okay. Because that was another one who did a Google search with your name and got to my website. And his thing was, I'm a friend of Kira and Derek's, actually a college roommate of Derek's. I've been trying to email him since Katrina, but his Tulane email address keeps bouncing. Do you have a different email for them? Have you heard anything? I'd appreciate any news. Thanks for posting the good wishes, and your friend Hugh Powell sent that. So,
I actually got an email from him. I checked last night. I haven't had a chance to get back to him.
Good. Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
This is kind of interesting because we have, I guess, it takes a hurricane to get us back in touch with our friends a lot of times. We've had, you know, just an outpouring of support from all of our friends.
Mm-hmm.
It's really nice, you know, and they ask us what we need, and we don't really know right now. That's
right.
The problem. And I guess if you get back to the middle class thing about all this is, you know, we don't know what we need because we have a little bit of money right now. Not a lot. I mean, we may have doctor in our title, but that doesn't mean we make money. We're not the money doctor.
Right. Your research position is not a particularly high-paying position,
right.
And Kira has a nonprofit she's running.
Right. We're the poor doctors. So, you know, but we don't qualify for anything. And, you know, when this little bit of money that we have been kind of, and it's, you know, I'm talking just a little bit in the paycheck, a little bit from last month's paycheck that's left over, you know, that's going to dry up pretty soon. And
mm-hmm.
It's actually getting very scary as, you know, we hear, oh, everybody qualifies for this money, and, oh, no, you don't, by the way, because
yeah.
you have insurance, or you have this, or you have that. And we're not going to get our insurance money until after, you know, we get into, they actually see our place, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it's like we're almost penalized for doing the right things at times. And, you know, I'm not asking for a government handout, and
mm-hmm.
but you also kind of feel like you don't deserve, you know, even sitting in line at the food stamp office, you wonder, well, you know, do I have it as bad as these other people, the people that have been shipped over to the Astrodome or
mm-hmm.
to Phoenix or wherever, and, you know, do I really have it as bad as these people?
You know, it's all relative, and that's
yeah.
the thing most people, I mean, when I, as a therapist, when I'm dealing with someone says, you know, gee, I'm really depressed about this, but I really shouldn't complain, and I really shouldn't be here talking about it because, you know, I'm not psychotic and I'm not on the street and stuff. And I said, you know what, pain is pain. Whatever our pain is about, whatever our struggle is about, it's still something we need to learn to cope with and we need to heal.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the other things that I think a lot of New Orleaners, the greater New Orleans area, is going to have to come to terms with, in addition to loss and grief, is going to be guilt
mm-hmm.
for those who made it,
right.
for those that had the means to get out of the city. Mm-hmm. I mean, Derek and I can't go do anything enjoyable without having a tremendous amount of guilt
right.
that we should do anything nice for ourselves given what's happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I just feel like we're stuck in between
right.
layers, and we're really not sure. And another frustrating part is it's the middle class that are most likely going to be the ones that are going back to the city and are going to be the ones rebuilding it.
Right.
But again, we're going to be the ones struggling the whole time.
Right. I want you, Kira, we only have like 5 minutes left, if that much, and I want you to talk for a minute about the nonprofit you've formed and what your plans are in terms of staying put and help using that nonprofit to rebuild a little bit.
Sure. We established last year the Prometheus Group, and the Prometheus Group is a nonprofit that really it was set up to do two things. One was help other nonprofits do a better job of being nonprofits and do better service delivery and linking and all those things. Louisiana draws down less support than anyone else in the nation, and we were trying to help build that capacity in the greater New Orleans area. The second thing we were doing was setting up a series of programs which were working with the hard-to-reach, underserved populations in providing, like, a community art center, providing different support services, mental health services, and linkages to other services for folks because it is such a disconnected, totally disconnected community. Since Hurricane Katrina, we had my staff and I were a combination of some of us have lost our homes. All of us are displaced right now all over the United States. And because I'm the executive director and talking with my staff, we've made a commitment that we are going back to New Orleans. We'll probably be one of the first groups in, and we will be there after everybody else pulls out. And we are going – one of the programs we will be providing is all of the things we just talked about psychotherapy-wise for victims of Hurricane Katrina that come back to the area.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So
good.
We – and, of course, all our contracts – all of our support just ended.
Right. So you have no income for the nonprofit right now either.
Correct.
Okay. So I want to tell people that if this, if I know that a lot of people are donating right now for the initial crisis and the loss that people are in need of food and clothing and shelter and all that stuff. When anybody who's listening is ready to help with the rebuilding process, even if it's right now. You can make donations to this nonprofit organization called the Prometheus Group.
Yeah, it's Prometheus, P-R-O-M-E-T-H-E-U-S group, and it's prometheusgroup.org on the internet.
Okay, what I'm going to do, Kira, is let people know that if it's easier for them just to get in touch with you through tellthetruthfaster.com, I will forward any emails and requests to make donations to you, and I will get my host to put up a link directly to that website from my website.
Sure, and if people go on the website, they can get a much better idea of who we are, what we have been doing, and what we plan to do. And I know a lot of people have been raising money and doing events, and part of our heartache is we're from there, we're going back there, and
right.
We'll be there. And so many organizations that are national or out of state are getting a tremendous amount of funding, but I want to see it used there.
Right.
Directly on the ground providing services.
Great. Well, listen, we only have like a minute and a half left.
Hopefully you have no callers.
No, actually, very often what happens is that the topics that I have usually are so interesting that I know there are people listening. Occasionally I get callers, but often I get emails after the show with people thanking me for it. So if any of you are out there and want to get some word to Kira and Derek or want to give me some feedback or them some feedback about today's show, I'd really appreciate you going to tellthetruthfaster.com and emailing me or them through that. Also, this show will be archived along with all the other shows I've done for the last 4 years are all up there and archived. And if you need any of this information, again, I want some friends to listen into it. In about a week or two, the show will be up and archived forever. So I want to thank you both. First of all, I want to thank Lauren for having the wherewithal to do the Google thing and get in touch with me, and your aunt and uncle for getting me a phone number. And I know we're not in touch all that often, but it was just ironic that it was just 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago that you and I had a long conversation while you were about your New Orleans business waiting to pick your son up from preschool, and you were sitting in the car, and I was hearing all the sounds of New Orleans going on around you. And So I'm really glad that we were able to reconnect, and I'm really glad you guys are safe. And I know you're going to be doing good things for your community when you're able to get back in there. And your prayers are with me, are coming from me all the time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stuart.
So thank you for taking the time, and I think this was an area that you're not hearing on any of the talk shows or anything, and I really appreciate your wisdom and input.
Thanks, and Stuart, you know we love you, darling.
Thank you. I love you both, too, and tremendous relief to hear your voices.
Thanks.
So all of you, I want to thank my listeners. This is Stuart Altshuler on Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM in Phoenix. Tune in next week where I'll be actually one of the speakers at Celebrate the Divine Feminine Conference in Sedona, and the topic of my workshop is The Goddess Wears a Beard, a workshop on reconciliation between the masculine and feminine within all of us and men and women within our society. So if you haven't checked that conference out, you can go to celebratethedivinefeminine.com or get the link on my website and join us up at Sedona next weekend. And I'm hoping to be doing the show remotely from the conference, so hopefully I'll be live next week from the conference in Sedona. This is Stuart Altshuler thanking all of you and sending our prayers out to everyone in the Gulf Coast area and all of those that have been dispersed around the country, that they find some peace and serenity and comfort wherever they are. So thank you for listening, and I'll be here next week.